Please welcome Shockley's Chairman of Medical Affairs, Health Science and Education, Dr. Jamie McManus.
Hello, Shockley family, and it's great to be with you here tonight for our monthly health science call. We hope you're doing well as we head into fall. I want to thank all of you who may have been aware that I had knee surgery a few weeks ago and the outpouring of cards. I had no idea there were so many different get well cards out there in the world. So thank you very much. I had kind of a freak accident, tore my meniscus in my right knee, kind of an ugly injury. But the good news is my joint is great. It's all fixed up now and slowly but surely getting back into my stiletto heels. Yes, I'm incorrigible. I will be back in stilettos. Okay, now on to the serious business of our call tonight, which is so serious, as you can tell by how I'm starting out tonight. We are, tonight's topic is the power of protein. We clearly have a very strong sense of the importance of protein in Shockley. We launched one of the very first soy protein isolate containing products way back in the 1970s, and before anyone was really making protein supplements, and have been, you know, a champion of the importance of and the versatility of using added protein shakes or protein powder products into your dietary regimen, into your supplementation regimen. So tonight, because we have so many new people joining us in Shockley, especially over these last few years, that we really wanted to just kind of step back and take a good look at what protein is, so that everyone out there is there talking about, you know, with your new customers and people in your organization about protein and taking and having protein be part of your daily. I mean, it's obviously, and we're going to go through this, it's an important part. It's one of the three main macronutrients, proteins, carbohydrates, and fat, that comprise or that deliver the calories that we consume on a day-in and day-out basis. Clearly, many of us are consuming too many calories. We have a tremendous problem with overweight and obesity in this country, which is not related necessarily to consuming protein, but consuming too much calories, not necessarily too much of anything or sometimes too much of everything. But we do want to provide you with a good understanding of protein, and some of the latest science. We're going to talk a little bit about specific types of protein tonight as well. And then, of course, at the end, we will open it up to Q&A, everyone's favorite part of our calls, I believe, although we'd like to think our content is very popular as well, which I'm sure you do all appreciate the content, but this is also a great opportunity to be able to ask questions that have been on your mind for yourself or your organization or someone new you just talked to today, possibly. So we're going to get right into it. Tonight, the call is going to be primarily driven by myself and Pam Manning, Senior Manager of Health Sciences, who is also a registered dietitian, an expert in dealing in the arena of diabetes, worked as a diabetes specialist for a number of years in between her two Shockley careers. And so we're going to start out with Pam sharing with you just exactly what is protein. Pam.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Jamie. Hello, everybody. Yeah, so we're just going to do a little basic protein 101 here. But when we talk about protein, proteins are actually a part of every cell, every tissue and organ in your body. And as Dr. Jamie said, we have dietary protein, which provides, you know, one of our energy nutrients and the necessary components, amino acids, to build all these body tissues and organs. And it's important to remember that these body proteins are constantly being kind of broken down and replaced. And this breaking down and building is kind of our called protein turnover in the body. So the protein in the foods that we eat is digested into its basic building blocks of amino acids, and that those are later used to replace all the various proteins in our body. And Dr. Jamie is going to go into all the functions of protein in our body and how that's so important to get adequate dietary protein to support those functions. So just as a reminder, I mean, most people know that protein-rich foods can be found in an assortment of animal-based proteins as well as vegetable-based proteins. So we have our meat, our poultry, and our fish. You have eggs, you have milk and other dairy products. And then on the plant side, you have your legumes, your dried beans and peas, tofu and other soy foods, nuts and seeds, and there's a small amount of protein in some vegetables although they provide a relatively small amount compared to the other proteins that I just talked about. So, Dr. Jamie, why don't you share a little bit with everybody about the primary functions of protein in the body?
Sure, you bet. And as we go through this, you will have a new and greater appreciation of why it is important that you do consume an adequate amount of protein on a regular basis. So we'll just go through some of the kind of from the most initial needs of protein all the way through some of the kind of the most esoteric, I guess we would say, needs or uses for protein, benefits of protein. First of all, protein is essential. It's one of our essential nutrients. We talk about essential amino acids and non-essential amino acids, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit. But protein is essential to growth, repair, and maintenance of all your body tissues, essentially. When you think of the growing fetus, that ultimately becomes a baby that starts with a single cell. The protein is an incredibly important part of essentially fetal development. Hair and nails. We clearly see people who have inadequate or imbalanced dietary intake of all sorts of things, including vitamins and minerals, but also protein may affect how their, how their hair looks, how their hair grows, their growth rate, nails as well. And again, there's multiple factors here, but protein is very important. Your intestines, both your intestinal tract and your skin are two of the most rapid turnover areas of your body or organ systems of your body, and so the protein is your protein level in your body is very important for supporting that constant process. That's a daily process of turnover. Enzymes, from digestive enzymes, which are very important in processing your calories, helping you process your calories. These are made from protein. Enzymes themselves make proteins, and enzymes also assemble and disassemble compounds in the bodies that are used to support the building blocks, essentially, of cells becoming tissues, becoming organ systems. Hormones, things like insulin and glucagon that you've heard about. You actually may not have heard about glucagon. People tend to know something or at least have a recognition of the word insulin, but this is a very important part of your glucose regulation system in your body. And so these hormones, other hormones such as estrogen and progesterone, essentially all the hormones in your body, and having the right balance and being able to deliver, these are not only compounds that have regulatory functions in your body, but also have messenger functions, so they're communicating between organ systems by virtue of the triggers that exist for regulating insulin secretion, glucagon secretion, et cetera. Protein helps your body maintain its proper fluid balance. It's very important in that. People that are protein malnourished can have significant swelling. In fact, that can be one of your signs of protein insufficiency in the diet can be edema in the ankles, swelling in the ankles. So in all the major body compartments, in maintaining how much fluid is in your tissues versus in your bloodstream versus in your organs and within the cells is all a very delicate balance that is controlled by multiple organs in your body. But your protein level certainly and proteins play a very important part in that. And then protein, of course, is clearly a delivery of calories, as we've talked about here already tonight. And we'll talk a little bit in a few minutes about different percentages of protein in the diet, but basically somewhere between 15 and 30% of your calories, for most people somewhere around 15-20% of your calories are provided by protein in your diet. And certainly your body can, if you're not getting in adequate amounts of protein, you can definitely be at risk for certain problems with your tissues. And then finally, protein is very important for helping your immune system from the standpoint of creating antibodies. And we know that that people that have very low total protein in their body, in particular, they may have an insufficient production of globulins, which are an important part of the immune system and help to create The antibodies that help you fight off viruses, bacteria, even things like fungus and things that you don't even think about because your body is so adept at responding to these sorts of challenges because you have adequate protein in your diet. Okay, so let's go on now and talk a little bit about how you know what kinds of protein to eat and a little bit of what we've been talking about as far as essential and non-essential amino acids and how to really understand good types of protein versus not so good types of protein. So, Pam.
Right, and what Dr. Jamie is really talking about is kind of protein quality. And most, you know, protein foods provide about 20 different amino acids, about half of which, a little bit more than half, are considered non-essential, meaning that your body can actually make them for itself. However, 9 are completely essential, and those must be obtained from dietary sources of protein. And what's interesting is, you know, unlike carbohydrates and fats that we consume, we don't really have a storage mechanism for amino acids in the body. So we really have to rely on a constant and steady supply from the protein-rich foods we eat every day. However, you know, not all dietary protein is, you know, created equally. And it really is the protein quality of one's diet that in large part, you know, determines how well a child's going to grow and develop and how well an adult's going to maintain his or her health. And so when we look at protein quality, there's kind of two key factors that influence the quality of protein, and they're generally thought to be protein's digestibility, and number two, it's kind of amino acid composition. Protein digestibility is a measure of the amount of amino acids absorbed from a given protein intake. And that amino acid composition refers to the availability of all the essential amino acids that we get from the food that we choose to eat. So in general, in kind of the simplest forms, animal source proteins, your meat, your fish, your poultry, eggs, and dairy are considered high quality because they contain all these essential amino acids. But soy also is considered to be a high quality protein, and it's a vegetable source protein, as you know. Other vegetable proteins like pea protein, whatnot, tend to be lower in overall quality in corn because they don't provide, you know, the complete essential amino acids. So they're also considered incomplete proteins. And those generally come from fruits, vegetables, grains, nuts, and typically fall short in providing adequate amounts of 3 primary amino acids. We call them kind of the limiting amino acids, lysine, methionine, and tryptophan, which are required for human health. Protein quality ratings have kind of, the way that they're evaluated have kind of changed over the years, but the most current standard that's used to assess protein quality is something called the Protein Digestibility Corrected Amino Acid Score. And this rating system uses a combination of a age-related amino acid reference pattern, which is actually based on preschool children, that represents a human requirement. Plus, it looks at estimates of the protein digestibility. Now, the amino acid composition of a particular protein then is compared to the amino acid composition of a reference protein and then adjusted for the digestibility. So using this current system, the highest quality proteins include soy, egg, milk, and beef proteins. Now, it's interesting when I was doing a lot of research kind of looking at this quality standards, there's a lot of discussion in the literature about, you know, whether this protein digestibility corrected amino acid score is really the best way to rate quality of protein, because it's not really capturing the importance of absolute amounts of certain essential amino acids in a particular protein source. So a lot of nutrition science is looking at, you know, should quality of protein be rated differently based on its role for different things, like how leucine is involved in the retention of lean body mass, protein in weight control, glucose metabolism. So it's looking like, you know, in the future there may be some evaluation of that and looking at things beyond just its limiting amino acids and digestibility score. So look for new research in that area emerging. So how much protein do you need? I mean, it's a good question, and depending on your particular situation, that can change. But in general, I'll just start kind of with, for an overall healthy adult, what the recommended dietary allowance is, and then Dr. Jamie can take it on and talk about some special needs and how that changes your protein requirement. So the recommended dietary allowance for most healthy adults is actually set at about 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight. And just to simplify that, if you weighed 170 pounds, that's about 62 grams of protein a day. Now, there are some studies suggesting that in older adults, you may benefit from slightly higher intakes, anywhere between 1 to 1.3 grams per kilogram. And that's thought because as we get older, we're eating, totally less energy intake. Our protein synthesis decreases a little bit. And so there's just some issues with aging that may require some additional protein. And we'll talk more about that later. So, Dr. J, why don't you share a little bit about some of the other special needs?
Sure, you bet. Thanks, Pam. Great job. So some of these we've talked about before in other formats, but just to kind of go over some special needs areas, pregnancy and breastfeeding, lots of young moms here that we're talking to in Shackley today and who can, benefit so much from not only these products but also a home-based business. So pregnancy has increased needs for calories overall, for certain vitamins and minerals in particular, as well as for added protein, about 1.1 gram of protein per kilogram, which means for the average pregnant woman, about 25 more grams of protein, so an additional 25 grams and approximately an additional 300 calories. I standardly, teach that during pregnancy, about 300 extra calories, during breastfeeding, about 500 extra calories per day. And with breastfeeding, you have an even slightly higher need for protein to create breast milk and good quality breast milk, about 1.3 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. So you divide that in half if you're talking about pounds, because the pound is about 2, it's actually 2.2 pounds per kilo. And then infancy and childhood, children have is between 1.5 and 2 times greater protein requirements per body weight. So whereas the adult, as Pam just talked about, is around 0.8 grams per kilogram, children are 1 to 1.5 grams per kilogram, in part depending on the growth phase. Kids, as all of you know who are parents, there are rapid growth phases, such as the first year of life, and then 1 to 2 years, they don't really grow so much, and their body weight doesn't even change by more than sometimes 3 or 4 pounds, whereas they go from 7 pounds to 25 pounds or something in the first year. So during the phases of childhood where there's more rapid growth, then they're usually going to eat more. And so that's just important to keep in mind as parents that you want to make sure you're offering your children good quality and a balance of all types of foods. And kids are actually pretty good at intuitively eating what they need to eat, assuming that those foods are provided for them. And so just to remember that protein needs are very important as well. So good quality protein and as well as protein that is not wrapped up in a lot of fat and extra calories like Happy Meals and things like that that aren't really too happy as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, another story. Vegetarians, especially vegans, definitely have to be concerned about consuming the proper quality of protein as well as the amounts of protein. Plant-based proteins even though they can be, sometimes they're complete and sometimes they're incomplete, like soy protein is a complete protein, but you have to have a variety. So I think if you focus on variety of proteins and using protein supplements, both soy and whey, and we'll talk a little bit about both of those in a moment, should really be emphasized. With athletes, or endurance exercise alters protein metabolism and can increase amino acid oxidation, which can lead to increased protein needs. This increase is certainly dependent upon, obviously, the intensity and the duration of the exercise. And so a little short run around the block does not mean that you need to eat another 20 grams of protein. But certainly people that are exercising regularly, that are, running 4 or 5, miles every other day, or training for marathons, or cycling or working out at the gym on a regular basis, intensely working out at the gym. Going to the gym actually does not count as working out at the gym. You actually have to get on the machines and use them, break a sweat, actually drip sweat would be the goal here. And then we can tell you that you do need some increased protein, up to 1.2 to 1.4 grams of protein per kilogram. So again, in the range of pregnancy and breastfeeding needs, so another 25, 30 grams. grams a day potentially if you're on average, and even higher if you were a big guy. People that are trying to build muscle, that are really into bodybuilding or are really using resistance training to increase strength and muscle mass, well, muscle mass more so than strength even, they require a protein intake far greater than that we've talked about here, and certainly far more than we would be recommending for more sedentary individuals. So the protein need for athletes who are really trying to bulk up essentially can be as high as almost 2 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. Weight loss is a whole other category. We've talked a lot about this, and when we talk about the Cinch products and weight loss in general, protein is one of the more satisfying macronutrients to consume, whereas carbohydrates can tend to lead to more hunger. Protein and fat tends to lead to a greater satiety, and so because protein has less calories per gram than fat, these high protein diets have become very prominent in the media and in the celebrity book aisle, et cetera. And certainly there are some studies to show that these high protein diets can promote significantly more weight loss compared to diets that are lower in protein, again in part because of satiety. But studies also suggest that if you can aim right into the 25% to 30% of calories from protein, which is kind of where we have our program, can promote greater rates of weight loss as well as helping to preserve lean body mass, which we have talked about a lot, so this is not new news to you. So that would mean that if you were consuming a 1,500 calorie diet, this would lead to over 100 up to 110, 115 grams of protein per day. So again, you're getting into a range of protein where you don't really want to be consuming that with a fat laden steak. You really want to be getting that from lower fat versions of protein products, where protein supplements can really play a good role. Now, the next just brief topic is from the medical side, are there limitations? Are there people that shouldn't consume protein supplements? And we get these questions in medical affairs from time to time. And the two main areas to be concerned about are your kidneys and your liver. For people that basically have healthy functioning kidneys and healthy functioning livers, there should be no protein limitations. The body should be able to deal with pretty much any amount of protein that you throw at it. There has been some controversy over the years about high protein diets causing kidney problems. There's actually been a number of studies that have really pretty much debunked that, that we do not have, that there basically just isn't evidence that that consuming a higher protein intake is going to harm your kidneys. But if you do have diminished kidney function for any reason, then you should talk with your doctor and maybe work with a dietitian, or you can talk with us. We can give you some guidance on this, but ultimately you should be working with your doctors and or a dietitian for your specific medical condition and your specific level of kidney function, because as the kidneys, for instance, if you have diabetes or you have nephrotic syndrome or you have glomerulonephritis or any of these significant and serious kidney disorders, still have protein needs. So getting inadequate protein is still very important, and that's why it's very important to be consuming the best quality of protein and the most digestible and absorbable types of protein. So it's not necessarily meat, and in fact, as Pam talked about tonight, oftentimes, animal protein is not necessarily the best protein to be consuming, and can lead to additional nitrogen load, as it's called, on your kidneys, and can stress your kidneys. So consuming too much of the wrong types of protein can be damaging to people who have already underlying kidney problems. And then same thing with liver disease. If you have someone who has cirrhosis of the liver, somebody who has chronic hepatitis C, and has definite diminished liver function, you do want to be a little more cautious. You wouldn't recommend someone consuming 100 grams of protein a day if they have any sort of liver dysfunction and or kidney dysfunction. So those are the kind of the big main categories. And other than that, again, all the reasons why you should be consuming protein. We'll get back to now some of the, we're going to now spend just a few minutes, and we really do think we can open up the lines a little bit earlier tonight for Q&A. Pam and I are going to go through a couple of studies that have, and just a couple of areas that we tend to get a lot of questions related to protein or soy protein specifically. Pam is going to start on kind of what we've just been talking about a little bit before, and that is protein and weight loss.
Yeah, that's right. I wanted to just highlight a little bit about the role of protein in weight loss. Dr. Jamie mentioned how slightly higher percentage of protein in your diet when you're on a weight loss program can be beneficial, and that's primarily believed to be because of protein's role in promoting satiety. And I read a fairly recent study in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition where researchers studied the effects of increasing protein intake in the diet while maintaining carbohydrate content on weight loss, appetite, calorie intake, and fat mass, actually in a small group of study participants. Now, initially, these folks were instructed to follow a weight-maintaining diet, and about 50% of their calories were coming from carbohydrate, and 15% from protein, and 35% from fat, and they did that for about 2 weeks. Then the next, after the 2 weeks, they were asked to follow a diet providing the same amount of calories, but changing up the macronutrient ratio. So they were getting 50% of their calories from carbs, 30% from protein, and 20% from fat. Then, 2 weeks later, they were given an ad libitum diet where they could just eat what they wanted, but they still had to stick with that 50% carb, 30% protein, and 20% fat composition. And they were allowed to eat, you know, what they wanted for about 12 weeks. And even though the subjects could eat as much food as they wanted in those 12 weeks, they actually reduced their calorie intake by an average of about 441 calories a day. That's pretty significant. And overall, over those 12 weeks, lost about 10 and almost 11 pounds of body weight and about 8 pounds of body fat. Now, there's been some other studies. It's very kind of a hot area looking at what are the mechanisms for satiety. And some interesting things. One of those was related to the fact that protein in the diet increases what we call diet-induced thermogenesis. Now, since the body doesn't have the ability to store any excess protein like we do with fat and carbohydrate, it has to be metabolized pretty immediately. And that actual metabolism stimulates something called gluconeogenesis, which is a process by which those amino acids, after you digest your protein, they're broken down to amino acids, they enter the blood, they're converted to glucose. And it's because they're converted to glucose, they help stabilize your blood sugar levels. And this steady blood sugar level over time then kind of prevents the increases in feelings of hunger that would typically occur with more of a higher carbohydrate diet. You know, you eat your carbs and then your blood sugar goes up and then comes back down, and it can institute feelings of hunger again or cravings for certain things. So this kind of helps keep blood sugar levels steady, thereby promoting more sense of satiety and fullness. And then the other area of interesting research is just looking at the effect of protein on different gut hormones. We have something called cholecystokinin and glucagon-like peptide 1, and these gut hormones in response to dietary protein are known to induce satiety and slow down the rate at which your stomach empties into your small intestine. So those might be some of the other mechanisms related to satiety and protein. So pretty interesting stuff. Now back to you, Dr. J.
Okay. Let's go on to the heart now, kind of an important organ in the body. We don't do very well without our hearts, so it's important to take care of them. And actually, 10 years ago, it's been 10 years since the FDA awarded a health claim to soy protein for its ability to reduce your risk of coronary artery disease, coronary heart disease, based upon the cholesterol-lowering effects of soy protein. So that's really a big deal. and something that I don't think we focus on enough when we talk about whether it's energizing soy protein or cinch shakes. I mean, these are providing this this soy protein that is low calorie, low cholesterol, I mean, low fat, no cholesterol. There's no cholesterol in soy protein. And so there's been over 100 clinical studies in humans that have been published about soy's cholesterol-lowering abilities. Between 2004 and 2007, there have been meta-analyses published also that have concluded that on average, soy protein can lower LDL cholesterol. The new focus now is more so on LDL cholesterol. That's the low-density lipoprotein fragment of the cholesterol molecule that actually is the most atherogenic, meaning the most dangerous in your body as far as leading towards atherosclerosis, atherosclerotic plaque, which is going to ultimately lead to a heart attack or stroke, depending on where the affected vessels are. And so to be able to lower your LDL cholesterol by 3 to 5% by consuming soy protein, and again, without any risk. I mean, we all know about the various pharmaceutical approaches to cholesterol management, which are oftentimes not a lot more dramatic effects than what we see here. But what we're seeing with soy protein is without any risk, you don't have to have your liver enzymes monitored. You don't have to worry about muscle problems. And which is, I'm not saying to not take those medications. If you need those, you need those. My concern with many of the pharmaceutical approaches is that people think they don't have to do anything about their diet. And so even for people who are consuming or needing to take a prescription medication to help with their lipid management, it does not diminish or limit in any way their need to follow a healthy diet. So again, soy protein is a fabulous way to substitute more healthy types of protein for some of the other protein choices that people may take. And so we know that by reducing your LDL cholesterol levels, you can reduce your risk of heart disease by 2 to 5%. Again, these are in the realm of what the pharmaceuticals can do as well. So to be able to achieve these sorts of or offer people options that they may not know are as powerful as they are, and doing really the right thing without any risk. And even more so than just helping with the cholesterol management, also can absolutely help people be eating a more healthful diet, which has many other benefits in addition to heart disease. Okay, back to you, Pam.
All right. The next kind of area of soy research that we wanted to mention was that the relationship between soy and colorectal cancer. And there's been a new study published this year in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. And in this study, researchers evaluated the relationship between soy food intake and colorectal cancer risk in about 68,000 women between the ages of 40 to 70 years from a study called the Shanghai Women's Health Study. So their usual food soy food intake was assessed through personal interviews with food frequency questionnaires, and they were followed up over a period of almost six and a half years. The colorectal cancer incidence was identified during that time period. Now, after they adjusted for any potential confounding factors, the total soy food intake was inversely related to colorectal cancer incidence in postmenopausal women. Now, for every 5 grams of soy food intake, and that was about an ounce of tofu a day, there was an 8% reduced risk of colorectal cancer. And then they looked at women with the highest intakes of soy, then they had a 33% reduced risk compared to those who had the lower intakes. And similar results were seen for soy protein and overall isoflavone intake. So some interesting research, again, in its chemoprotective effects. Dr. J, you want to talk a little bit about breast cancer?
Yes, absolutely. Another area of great interest and great angst out there in the world because it hasn't the information hasn't been clear, and I can't say that we have definitive answers for everything at this point, but there is an emerging body of evidence that really gives us a greater level of confidence. I mean, those of us who really have been recommending and seeing people consume soy protein as part of their diet on a regular basis have had a level of confidence of the safety of soy protein, even protecting against breast cancer, or even in people who already have existing, you know, breast cancer, their post treatment breast cancer survivors, and there's many thousands into the millions at this point out there of cancer survivors, and well, definitely in the millions of cancer survivors out there. So this becomes more and more important information. So there has been really considerable discussion of this, and there's a lot of opinions out there, and so I'm going to summarize here what the studies are telling us right now, and then kind of where we are at this point. So we know that that in a fairly recent review of studies based on Asian populations, which is where this all began, looking at people in Asia who seem to have a much lower incidence of breast cancer, colon cancer, ovarian cancer, prostate cancer, you pretty much can pick a number of different cancers, and you're going to see lower risks in many of the Asian population, Japanese or Chinese, but in particular, a lot of this has looked at the Japanese because there's also a significant Japanese American population, and there's actually were studies 15, 20 years ago at this point looking at women in Japan versus first and second generation Japanese American women, and seeing just kind of a stair-stepped up incidence of breast cancer and ovarian cancer. And so their genetics did not change in one or two generations, and what was changing was their environment and their diet. And so that has spurred a lot of studies and a lot of interest in what is different about the Asian diet, in particular the Japanese diet, and certainly some of it is focused certainly on soy. So anyway, these studies looking at Asian populations, and this is a fairly recent review article, showed that the higher soy intake was associated with an overall 29% reduced risk of breast cancer specifically, so almost a 30% reduced risk of breast cancer. Despite, you know, many of these positive findings in various studies, the relationship between soy and breast cancer continues to be, as we've said, an area of controversy. Some of this comes from 10 to 15 years ago, some cell culture studies that were published and animal studies looking at fairly high intakes or fairly high delivery of isoflavones, which are the plant estrogen-like compounds, phytoestrogen, in soy foods, and it showed a stimulant effect on the growth of breast cancer cells. So a lot of the angst has come from these cell culture studies, not from human data whatsoever. We're finally getting, some studies that have been published now that we can, you know, we can kind of really start to kind of hopefully put that into perspective. There are several studies here that have suggested that women with breast cancer can consume soy safely. Most of the more nutritional experts out there recommend that soy foods are generally safe, especially as part of a overall healthy diet, even for breast cancer survivors. There are human studies that show that isoflavones do not stimulate breast cancer breast cell proliferation. It is the proliferation or overproliferation of breast tissue that can lead to cancerous changes and a cancer ultimately developing. Also, there are studies showing that isoflavone consumption does not increase breast density. Breast density itself does not lead to an increased risk of breast cancer, but it can make it more difficult to find a cancer on mammography or on even breast self-exam, the more dense your breast is. And there's been some theory out there that consuming soy is going to make your breast tissue more dense, and so there's some new evidence saying that's not the case. And in one study recently, neither soy nor isoflavone intake was related to the length of disease-free survival time for breast cancer patients. So over a five-year follow-up, there was no difference whether they consumed soy or isoflavones or did not. So again, that lack of any negative effects is another good piece of information in the overall decision-making process that people have to go through. Another study showed that a higher soy intake was associated with a more favorable outcome in both overall mortality, in other words, likelihood of dying or time at which death occurs after breast cancer, as well as disease-specific mortality, meaning a relapse and death from the breast cancer. So again, a higher soy intake was associated with a lower likelihood of having a bad outcome, essentially. And even better news, again, saying, you know, soy foods can, you know, can impact survival in a more positive way. And that, and some of this was also focused on giving us information about the specific type of cancer. Estrogen, we talk about estrogen receptor positive or estrogen receptor negative. You also have progesterone receptor positive, but the estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, that's been the subset of breast cancer that we've had some concern just because of the slight parallel of estrogen and phytoestrogen, even though phytoestrogens are very weak, and most scientists that really look at soy and phytoestrogens don't really believe that phytoestrogens can have anything close to the stimulant effect as the very potent estrogen that your body produces, or as we see in women who consume estrogen receptor, estrogen replacement hormone therapy. Those are very potent pharmacologic level amounts of estrogen. Very different from consuming soy protein. So again, you know, I think the bottom line is that we continue to amass favorable evidence that soy protein, that it's safe to consume soy protein. If you have a family history of breast cancer or even if you've had breast cancer, but we do always suggest that you discuss this topic specifically with your doctors and with your oncologist. We're happy to provide studies and references and that sort of thing, or have a conversation with your doctors should they want that. So that's going to close it up for soy protein for a second. We're going to switch gears a little bit now and talk about, and we're happy to answer your questions when we get to the Q&A here in just a few minutes. We're going to close up here with our final portion of our protein update today. Pam's going to tell you a little bit about the latest on whey protein.
All right. So we know that aging is associated with a slow progressive loss of skeletal muscle mass. It's also known as something called sarcopenia. And we've talked about this in other in health sciences hotlines and things like that. But basically, sarcopenia, so if you're losing skeletal muscle mass as you age, that's accompanied by a reduction in strength, a loss of your functional capacity, and it's also associated with increased, you know, risk of chronic diseases. And it's believed to be caused by a number of factors, including, you know, as we age, our lifestyle becomes more sedentary, and then maybe a less than optimal diet, maybe not getting enough dietary protein and calories. And when they take a little closer look at age-related changes in muscle mass, they seem to be attributed to kind of a disruption in skeletal muscle protein turnover. As I talked about, protein in the body is constantly being built and broken down, so there's this constant turnover taking place. And it looks, you know, as we age, the rates of muscle protein breakdown are greater than, you know, the building of the protein. So over time, that leads to a gradual loss in muscle mass. It's kind of like how our bones operate. We're building and breaking down bones, and as we age, we break down more than we build, and so you get this negative, you know, loss in the end of the day. And then when they've, you know, looked at younger people, when you consume dietary protein, younger folks tend to, that promotes muscle protein synthesis. So you eat dietary protein, it stimulates muscle protein synthesis. But as we age and you go into the older years, your ability to do that is blunted a little bit. So you're producing much less muscle protein synthesis in response to your dietary protein intake. So all of this has kind of led to research in the area of using leucine-enhanced protein supplements to hopefully offset the loss of muscle mass as we age. And in this particular study, they did use a whey protein beverage enhanced with leucine. This particular study I'm going to talk about was, again, published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition a couple years ago. And researchers looked at muscle protein synthesis response to either Just dietary carbohydrate alone or a combination of carbohydrate, whey protein, and leucine in two different groups of men. Eight younger men who were about 20 years old and eight older men who were about 75 years. And the subjects were randomly assigned to two crossover experiments, so they each got to, you know, do each treatment and consume those treatments after performing 30 minutes of just kind of their standard activities of daily living. And then the researchers evaluated the rates of muscle breakdown and muscle protein synthesis. They were measured. And the results of this study found that overall muscle protein synthesis rates were significantly greater with the consumption of that combination of carbohydrate, protein, and leucine than the carbohydrate intake alone. And then more interesting was that these muscle protein synthesis rates did not significantly differ between the young and older men. And I said earlier that, you know, as we age, the rates of muscle protein synthesis tend to be decreased as we age. So this suggests that this, you know, supplementation of the protein and leucine and carbohydrate combination kind of offset that, and that it kind of balanced it out so that the older folks were producing as much muscle protein synthesis as the younger men. So that was an interesting study. And I think that's it.
That's the news we have for you today. Actually, we always have more news, but that's our protein presentation for today.